I should mention to you that Tiffany goes to boarding school now. She sort of cracked in eighth grade, the taunting about her sixth toe sending her over the edge the same year Ricky sold his first screenplay for like $1 million, seriously. And so Tiffany got some kind of elective foot surgery to remove the toe, and then Ricky paid for her to go away to Michigan, to this school where you ride horses all day and they don't give you grades. Oh, don't worry about waking her up, I say. It's super early. I bet she was out late last night doing things those wacky kids like to do. Mrs. Devlin does the adult version of laughing at a teenager's joke, which sounds like heat pipes being turned on for the first time after a long summer. All our summers are long. Same with our winters. Tiff's boyfriend visited from Michigan, so we all went to South Hills Village for dinner. It was fun. There's a new seafood place that's pretty good. Her boyfriend, I say, as if a high school girl with a boyfriend is such an earth-shaking statistic. Yeah, they met at school. It's just Tiffany was always younger than Annabeth, and Annabeth never got to have a boyfriend. Doesn't seem right. He's a lovely young man. Is he inside? I say, gesturing wildly as if they allowed a convict into the house. My brain can't keep up with the math that a six-toed girl has a lovely young man visiting her from Michigan and my sister is in an urn. No, no, Mrs. Devlin says. We put him up for the night. He's at the Hilton on McMurray Road. That's cool, I say, like an idiot. Mrs. Devlin walks down the little slope of their grass, meeting me on the sidewalk and putting her hair up in a ponytail. Well, Quinn, I am really glad to see you outside, finally. Some moms can still pull off the ponytail look. Yeah, I actually went to Kennywood yesterday with Jeff and some friends, I say, turning around and pointing at our house as if it is a theme park. My geography is all off. That's when I notice these weird little black ribbons tied around the trees on our block. Huh. It was fun. Was there something you wanted from me, hun? Mrs. Devlin says. No, I just... Last night, I stayed up till like 4, rewatching some of the movies we made in your yard, so, I don't know, I saw you out here and I wanted to, like, look at it again. For old times. She tilts her head at me. Well, okay, hun. Feel free to hang out. I think I'll get back to my garden, though. Yes, I say, clapping once. Of course, you do that. I'm going to dash. I turn and look both ways, as if you have to on this road. You don't. And just before I step off the sidewalk to head back up to my hot room and wonder why I came outside at all. Oh, Quinn, Mrs. D says. You'll be interested in knowing something. I turn back around. Uh-huh. Rick's finally coming back to town. Wait, Ricky Devlin? I say it like a moron, but that's the only way I can picture his name. Ricky Devlin is always how you say his name, like he's Charlie Brown or something. Stop and picture it for a second. None of the other peanuts ever calls him just Charlie. She giggles. Yes, Ricky Devlin, my Ricky. Oh, wow, the golden boy returneth. He and his partner are going to be here for 2 weeks while the movie shoots. Brain overload. I'm sorry, wait, what? Mrs. Devlin bounces the shovel handle on her hip. Well, honey, didn't your mother tell you? I look back at the dangerous wooden roller coaster that is my house. No, I say. I mean, maybe she did. I've been forgetting things a lot. Mrs. Devlin shakes her head. Of course you have, hon, of course you have. From this angle, with the sun coming up slow behind her chimney, and me knowing that Tiffany is asleep inside and that her boyfriend is staying down the road at a Hilton, Mrs. Devlin looks like a mirage. Ricky and his partner, Juan, are coming in from L.A. to be guests on the set of his movie. They're embroidering chairs for them and everything. The No Such Thing as Fire sequel? I say. If this were a cartoon, my eyes would have bugged out of my head. But this isn't a cartoon. This is the live-action tragedy known as my life. And so my glasses have remained snugly in place. No, hon, this is something else. Very indie. Look it up online. The Post-Gazette did a huge piece. It was in Variety, the whole deal. You go, Mrs. Devlin. I love that she's so Hollywood now. She can't even bother to give me the log line to her son's newest movie. At 7:15 a.m. on a weekday in the summer, by the way. Well, that's amazing. I scratch my arms. Apparently, I'm covered in mosquito bites. Well, they're looking for extras for a crowd scene this week in Station Square, Mrs. Devlin says, finally turning around to head back to her precious weeds. Maybe you and Tiffany could have fun in the background together, like the old days. I can ask Ricky. Almost like the old days, I say to Mrs. Devlin, except Annabeth won't be directing this one. Unless she will be, somehow. I actually stand here 1 second longer, because this news that Ricky is actually gay and that he's about to shoot an independent movie back home when all his other films have been big-budget CGI cheese fests, it's all such a crazy casserole of headlines that for all I know, Annabeth is directing it. Annabeth's directing and Mom's playing the romantic lead. And Dad's coming home. And not just to pick up his shorts. And I'm happy again. No, that's right, hon, Mrs. Devlin says, yanking so many weeds at once that she accidentally pulls out the one lone, robust flower, too. Annabeth's not directing this one. She points over my shoulder, and I look back. I think your porch lights are flashing. Chapter 15. You would not say Vanessa is thrilled to see me, but I am a paying customer and she can't kick me out. I think that's in the Constitution somewhere. I take my iced coffee to the practically Parisian leather armchairs and wait for Jeff to bop over. Except he doesn't bop over, he walks over. I seriously can't talk for long today, he says. Vanessa kind of rode me hard the last time you were here. I slowly raise my eyebrows. And you liked it. Quinn, come on. Something's up when your straight friend doesn't laugh at sex references. Okay, I have a favor to ask. I can install it tonight, he says. Like, I can bring it over after family dinner night. This is a weekly thing in Jeff's house, even in summer. Can you imagine such traditions being performed without irony? Oh, the AC, I say. Yes, I need that. Well, what else? He says. He's being really impatient with me. Unusual. I kind of rely on Jeff for, like, all-you-can-eat niceness. I was sort of hoping you could get a message to Amir through Carly. Jeff slaps his hands down on his green-aproned thighs. Dude, seriously, this is like medieval times. This is embarrassing. You should just send a smoke signal or something. I'll buy a phone tomorrow for my birthday. Happy birthday, me. No, you won't. I will, I say. But Jeff's right. I won't. Also, my phone isn't even broken. I technically don't even need a new one. Uh-oh, she's back. Jeff. Vanessa heads to the fixings bar to refill the soy milk, and Jeff looks at her and then back at me and goes, Fine, I'll get one message to Amir one more time, but that's it. What is it? Why are you so pissed with me? Why are you being such a little biatch? Jeff doesn't say anything. He just stands there with his lips pursed. Just tell him to, like, pick me up for the film festival around 7 tonight outside my neighborhood. Like, just before you turn in after the Jiffy Lube on Willow. I know where you mean, Quinn. Jesus, okay. Vanessa clanks the soy milk down and turns to head back to the counter, and so I turn to head back to my bike. And right before taking off, I try to flash the all-new peace sign back at Jeff through the window, but he's not looking at me. He's pretending to wipe down the counter, but the counter was already spotless. I saw it. I see everything. It's the worst. On my way home, I pull over and look for fireflies, but all I see is grass and litter, grass and litter. And I'm thinking, maybe I never saw a firefly the other day to begin with. that maybe I'm the unreliable narrator of my own life. I'm in our basement, which is twice as humid as New Orleans looks in A Streetcar Named Desire. "It should be on top of one of the filing cabinets," Mom's saying from the top of the stairs. She swears there's some old stationery down here, and she is anxious to write a note to Mrs. Devlin to thank her for organizing the black ribbons on our block. "I'll find it, Ma. Just go back and watch your stories." So she does. She takes off, and plumes of dirt rain down on me. Apparently, the ribbons went up on all the trees in January as an awareness tribute to Annabeth and to driving safely, but neither Mom nor I got the memo. Actually, we probably did. The mail upstairs is approaching a Pisa level of tipping over on the counter, and I bet a community announcement went out and got lost in the pile. But we've still kind of refused to do anything but let it build up. I'm making my way through brittle yellow stacks of newspaper clippings down here, old articles proclaiming my grandpa's latest patent. He's what you'd have called an inventor or an entrepreneur, which is French for never made enough money to leave Pittsburgh. Finally, I see Mom's old stationery, her monogram printed in bumpy purple ink. And when I swipe it from the top of the filing cabinet, it leaves behind this dust-free rectangle on the glass of a framed photograph. It's of a beautiful woman on her wedding day. She is marrying a terrible man who is annoyingly good-looking, like movie star handsome. It's unfair. They are standing underneath a tree that looks like the tree we have out front, the one that Annabeth and I tied the stray dog to that we weren't allowed to keep. But it isn't that tree. My parents got married in Ohio after a lusty courtship. They went bowling on their first date, and my mom was so goo-goo over Dad, she wore the bowling shoes home and was fined $20. Why do people have to fall out of that kind of love? He is smiling so hard in this wedding photo. "Something in the water in this town," Mom used to say all those years later, when they moved to Pittsburgh and Dad wasn't smiling anymore. When he would come home from the office and disappear into the basement and not even care enough to slam the door. He wasn't even passionate enough to slam it. What was he doing down here? We don't have a TV or a carpet or even finished walls. Was it just because this was the only place he could hide? I'm thinking yes. I'm thinking yes because that's kind of what I'm doing right now. "Found it, Ma," I say, turning their wedding photo face down on the filing cabinet, bringing the stationery up to her in the sunroom, and directing myself to smile for her, damn it, while I do it. Chapter 16. I spritz myself once with Dad's cologne. I swab my face twice with Mom's rubbing alcohol. I put on my only white-collared shirt, and then I spend 15 minutes figuring out how to roll up my sleeves the sexiest way. No, I seriously Googled the sexiest way to roll up sleeves and got 2.3 million hits. GQ did a whole slideshow thing. How is time so elastic that you can piss away an entire day and then be late for your first one-on-one date ever? I'm leaping down the stairs three at a time when I note that Mom's barricading herself at the foot of them. There is almost a whole crash scene here, but she doesn't flinch. "Will you put this in the mailbox for the morning?" she says. "You mean just walk it across the street?" I say, taking Mom's card from Mrs. Devlin. You should see my mom's handwriting. The thing is art. "No, no, no," she says. "It's actually against the law to not mail a piece of mail. It's a federal offense to open a neighbor's mailbox." Well, that's a new level of nuts. But I kiss her cheek and say, "No problem, Ma, I'll just put it in our mailbox. But first," I pull a few newspaper clippings from behind my back, presenting them to her like an inky bouquet. "I thought you'd have fun looking at these. There's like 100 piles of them in the basement." She grins. "It's a bunch of articles on Grandpa's inventions and stuff." "Well, his almost inventions. Nothing ever got off the ground," But you know what? She's not saying it like she's disappointed. She's saying it like she can't believe she doesn't reread these every day. This lifeline to a past when her life was still going to turn out nice, maybe even mythical. The daughter of a mad, wealthy inventor. "I got a jet," I say. "But don't read them all at once or you'll get a toothache." No idea what that means, but I say it in that detective voice that always makes her laugh. And so I'm caught short when I rush by Mom to head out the door, and instead of giving me that signature chuckle, she just goes, "You're sure putting on a lot of cologne for Jeff lately." I don't even respond. I just let the door slam shut behind me. Then I stand on our crumbly porch and think, shit. And I drop the card in our mailbox, and I keep walking. Nobody wears watches anymore. I don't know what time it is, but I feel like I've been standing out here for longer than I should. I was already running late, I mean. But you should see the sky tonight. Screw your astrology app. Screw your games. Look up sometime. There is a whole wing of positive psychology, my therapist told me, that says the greatest way to affect your outlook on life is to consider what you already have more than what you don't have. And so I might not have a cell phone on me or a sister at home or a dad at all or a future, but holy shit, I have the sky. A car pulls around the bend from Willow tomorrow, and even though it's too big to be Amir's old Saturn, I still find myself adopting an exaggeratedly casual posture, literally yawning as if I hadn't prepped for this date by putting on my best underwear, you never know, and a white shirt and one exact spritz of polo. But it's not Amir. The car kicks up enough dust to back me up into a neighbor's chain-link fence, and that sends their dog, Lucy, running up and barking at me. "Quiet, Lou," I say, bending down. Lucy actually starred in a Q&A short. It was called White Puff of Magic. Ugh, the titles. And even though it was only like 6 minutes, it was a pretty sweet and effective movie. My latest film was the most ambitious. It was going to be a full-length feature. Annabeth shot the first 4 scenes last fall, and I looked at the footage and thought the whole thing felt too dark. It was meant to be a slightly black comedy, but it was coming off as super self-serious. So I asked Annabeth to reshoot, and she grunted in my general direction and said, "I am in the middle of filling out my college applications, you ungrateful ingrate. How about you write that character recommendation I keep asking you for, huh?" Annabeth had to include a couple of character recommendations from adults in mentor positions for her college applications. She asked her AP psych teacher to write one for her, but Mrs. Wadsworth went, "I have to write about 30 of these every year, Annabeth, so what I'd ask is that you write a first draft and I'll go from there, okay?" "But how am I supposed to know what's special about my own freaking character?" Annabeth said to me over and over this past fall, like a toddler or a parrot. And I got the hint and promised I'd write one of the character recommendations for her that Mrs. Wadsworth could just sign if she wanted, that it wouldn't be a big deal. And then I just never did. Brother of the year. Lucy's little eyes go from yellow to red, possessed. The fence is suddenly lit up, and I realize the light is coming from behind me. Still squatting, I turn to wave as Lucy trots away, and now I wonder, what the hell does it look like I'm doing? "What are you doing?" Amir says, rolling down his window. He's not being mean, though. He's really just asking. "Neighbor's dog," I say. Why did I let Lucy lick my hand? Am I now the kid who smells of mutt tongue and polo? I get into the front seat, and it's set too far back so that my already shortish legs have miles to swim. And Amir goes, "Feel free to adjust the seat." And I go, "Okay, cool," because I was like, and then I don't have anywhere to go with that. "Hi," he says when I've pulled myself forward. "Hi," I say. "Sorry I'm late. You ready?" So ready. And off to a Japanese film festival in Shadyside we go. I'm actually really excited. Tonight they're screening Seven Samurai, a 1954 movie that kind of set the standard for modern action cinema. Amir already has the movie theater address plugged into this GPS thing on his dashboard and everything, which is really sweet. He's really planned this out and isn't, like, acting cool. There's maybe nothing nicer than somebody just coming straight out and showing you they like you. "Okay, can I start with an apology?" he says, "after you buckle up." He shifts gears, and I'm thinking nothing is hotter than a guy who drives stick shift. "Sure." "I am really super embarrassed about what I said about overweight people."
"You mean how it gives you the willies?"
I actually say.
"It's okay, you didn't know."
"It's not okay." We zoom by the Andersons' place down the hill. "I was just making conversation at lunch," Amir says. "I have this thing where when I'm nervous, I talk too much."
"I'm over it, seriously."
Amir turns onto St. Clair. "I'm sitting here in auto-copilot mode, coasting along on a path I've taken 1,000 times, not thinking. But when we get to the fork where I found the Firefly, Amir makes a right. He's heading toward the school. "Oh, shit," I say, and he goes, "What? What?" And I go, nothing. Amir gets a text. I hear it buzz in his pocket. And he reaches for it, and I can't help myself. I just can't. And I say, "Please don't look at that." And it makes him laugh, because even I can hear the pitch in my voice, the matronly timbre scolding a kid for doing what kids do.
"Okay,"
he says, pushing buttons through his shorts to silence the phone. I hate that I've made this awkward. No, I hate that Annabeth has.
"So, have you ever seen a Japanese film?" Amir goes.
"I think I only saw the original Godzilla at a sleepover once, but it may have been one of the 1 billion remakes." And there goes the library, and there goes the volunteer firehouse, and there goes the old putt-putt, and I can't look away. I can't look away. We pull up to the very red light that Annabeth ran right outside the school, and as I'm staring and staring at the horribly specific and distorted portrait of Annabeth, Amir goes, "Yo, I'm sorry." This almost snaps me out of it, but it doesn't, not totally.
"Sorry," I say,
"for driving you right in front of your high school on summer break." I check his face. Nope, no pity. "You must want to get as far away from it as possible." He still doesn't know. They didn't tell him. Carly and Jeff have allowed that to be my final trick of the night. "It's green," I say, when the light changes and reflects off his glasses. You can tell he really needs them, because in the angle he's using to stare at me, his eyes take on this distorted, old-fashioned Coke bottle quality. He really does need his glasses, and I really don't need mine. "The light," I say, when he's still looking at me as if I am the dead kid whose face is spray-painted into the spackled wall of my school, "is green." Somebody honks. Amir's engine revs up. We pull away, but my thoughts don't. My thoughts linger back at the school like smoke. They smolder. And yet they are without heat. They are a fire without ashes. My thoughts are one great big nothing. It takes us weirdly forever to find parking, and then the line to the front of the theater is jackrabbit roller coaster deep. And so by the time we get to the ticket counter and find out they're down to one remaining seat, Amir looks like he's going to lose his mind. "It's cool," I say, because it really is. I don't think I can handle a Japanese film right now. Anytime I have to read, my mind instantly wanders, and I don't want my mind instantly wandering. I want my mind instantly obliterated. She genuinely looked like a dog. My beautiful sister. As if an art director said to a gang of middle schoolers, "Please paint a dog on the side of the school and tie a black ribbon around its ears," and voila, they nailed it. "Well, should we get a frozen yogurt or something?" Amir says, and yes, we absolutely should. That is a great idea. I take the liberty of tasting 3 different samples at the yogurt place, and it isn't until I'm filling up my official Froyo cup with way too many opposing flavors that I see what I'm doing, giving my brain an intentional overload. Yes,
I just keep saying at the counter when the girl asks which toppings I want. And so after graham cracker crumbs and this raspberry sauce thing and gummy bears and kiwi and white chocolate chips, Amir puts his hand very gently on my lower back, not like we're moving up in line, but like he's saying, "That's enough, Quinn." And this is the moment I fall in love with him. He pays for us. We find weird chairs that have these impractical little tufts of butt padding. Approximately one bite into my yogurt, I look at the thing as if I'm coming out of a particularly vivid hypnotism session, and I start giggling. It looks disgusting. "Holy shit." "Is right," he says. "What'd you get?" "An extremely sensible peanut butter and chocolate combo, solid, classic." I instinctively reach my spoon across to try his. There isn't a person in my life who I can't do this with. My life is best friends or nobody. My life is Jeff. Amir pulls his cup away. "Say please," he says in this twangy way that gives please like two separate syllables and gives me like one solid boner. And so I say please and take a bite. I don't even offer him any of mine because, really. "So where are you going next week?" I say. "Wait, did Carly tell you I'm leaving town?" "No, you did." "Oh," he laughs too hard. Wasn't a good line, wasn't even a line. The music in here is blasting, really blasting, so that I have to lean forward a bit to hear him. I am okay with this. "I got into this writing workshop thing," he says, rolling his eyes again. I want him to own how hot he is. "Oh, no way." "Way." He eats frozen yogurt slower than anybody on earth. "So, like," I say, "what kind of writing workshop?" "Ah, it's lame. Do you read novels? Don't answer that. Nobody ever gives the answer I want." "Man, do I get that. Try being a screenwriter and watching your nearly perfect sequence get obliterated by a passing airplane in the middle of a scene that's supposed to take place in the 1800s. "I love novels," I say, loudly, louder than the music level even calls for. "Okay," he says, not believing me, which he shouldn't. "I don't love novels, or I don't like anything assigned to me." Crap, now he's saying something about San Francisco. "I love San Francisco," I say. Everything is love or hate with me these days. I hope I just like or dislike some stuff in my 17s and 18s. "Oh, my God, I turn 17 tomorrow. Holy shit, that sounds old." "Oh, you've been to SF?" he goes, but I haven't been. And this brain-freezing business is no joke. I shake it off. "Sorry, I'm, like, distracted by how cold this is." I hold up my goop. We laugh. I've never been to San Francisco, but there is a pretty campy Bond scene filmed there over the Golden Gate Bridge, which you have to visit. "Bond? James Bond. Oh." He set me up. Clever guy. "Anyway," he goes, "my writing workshop isn't in San Francisco proper. It's going to be farther down on the peninsula." I have never totally understood peninsulas. It's like, are you an island? Pick what you are, peninsulas. I've spaced out again. He is staring at me. "I'm sorry," I say, too confidently tossing my cup across the room and absolutely missing the garbage can by nothing less than a yard. We crack up. I pick it up, wipe off my hands, and turn back to see Amir making a big frowny face and pointing at my stomach. When I look down, there is a full-on gummy worm attached to my shirt by means of chocolate sauce. "Oh, no way," I say at my shirt. "Way," Amir goes. Somehow, in the span of 20 seconds, he has acquired a little thing of warm water and a towel from the front counter. He's squatting low, dabbing at my shirt and kind of fixing me up. It's the sweetest thing. "I think that should take out most of the stain," he says, looking up at me. Some bro types are leering at us, and Amir says, "Shall we?" and motions to the door, and I say, "Duh," and we're on the muggy street in 2 seconds flat. "You said you were sorry back there," Amir goes, "immediately after you spilled chocolate sauce on yourself like an adorable invalid and directly before we were nearly hate-crimed into the history books?" "Whoa, you are a writer," I'm saying, but really I am stalling because I can't remember what I'm sorry about. So much, really. Everything. "Ha," he goes, "don't tell my straight-ass parents I'm a writer. They think I'm going to San Francisco to intern for a startup. They don't approve of my clandestine plan to write the great Iranian-American novel." It's coming to me now. When I was zoning and brain freezing, he mentioned San Francisco in regards to this writing program. I can fake this. "So, will you know other people at the, like, your writing program?" "Eh, I can tell you more about the program later. We should decide what we want to do tonight." "Oh, that's nice. I thought that yogurt and a wardrobe malfunction was sort of it for our first date." "Crazy idea," Amir says, grabbing my shoulder and steering me into an alley between two brick buildings. "Oh my God, is he going to kiss me? Is this it? I still have gummy bear, etc. breath. Do you like to bowl?" I hate to bowl, but the poetry of it all. Mom beating dad on their first date. "I love bowling," I say, and Amir takes my hand, and a field of fireflies appears inside my chest, and they all light up at once. Chapter 17. We are three rounds into bowling, and I don't really totally understand how the scoring works, but for whatever reason, I have been able to turn this into a running bit. Like I'm Goldie Hawn in some 80s screwball comedy. "You're up," I say to Amir, after another of my bowling balls goes straight into the gutter. I did not inherit my parents' genes for this pastime. And in one brief, shining moment, I wonder if perhaps I am adopted. Somehow that would make Annabeth's death feel not so personal. Amir has a whole stance and everything, where he holds the ball close to him like the thing is a fragile baby, and when he releases it, he grunts a little, not as a joke. And the ball knocks down 5 of the pins, which for me would be cause to go to Disney World, but seems to genuinely bum him out a bit. "I thought that was a triumph," I say, but his thanks suggests he's a straight-A student who's never happy with anything but the best. Jesus, wait till he sees the inside of my house. "Were you a straight-A student in high school?" "Still am," he goes, sitting down again. His shirt is a little too tight and his chest strains against it, and I'm saying this is a great thing. "Well, that's got to be a lot of pressure." The group next to us lets out the kind of whoop and hoot that only Pittsburghers know how to do. Seriously, you wouldn't believe the pride and commitment to sports if you didn't live here, and even then. "Quinn," Amir says, poking my knee with his finger. "Yeah? I said, you've got to be a pretty good student too, right? I mean, you're so quick." "You should see me in gym class. I could challenge that notion." "Ha, see? Quick." I don't need Amir knowing how I just coast by academically, so I do that thing where I pretend to cough. "Do you want some nachos or something?" Amir goes, and I say, "or something," because I like when dialogue echoes in movies, but I'm secretly hoping he really does bring back nachos specifically. He walks away, and I study him. I am the only person in this incredibly loud bowling alley who doesn't have his phone out, multitasking. Amir's jeans are just a little too baggy, so when they hang down, some underwear is sticking out, and it's the boxer variety, which just drives me delirious. "Nachos," he says, back with a plate of the grossest and most wonderful-looking dinner I have had in a while. "You like jalapenos?" "Love 'em," I say, because I like them. "Okay, go to town," he says. "Jalapenos, licorice, humidity." "Things you hate?" "Bingo." A group of not-naturally-blonde girls stumbles into our area, and I feel offended somehow. But when Amir leaps up and goes, "Would you guys like this, Lane? We're just having a snack." Somehow I end up liking them.
"Cool, whatever,"
one of them goes, followed by a chorus of, "Whatevs, sure." And Amir and I are taking the nachos to a little snack bar area that feels a million miles from the school cafeteria.
"So what do they want you to do?"
I say. "Damn it, Quinn, set him up better. You're getting all Jeff with your lack of context."
"What does who want?"
Sorry. I should have set that up better. "What do your parents want you to, like, study?" He runs his hands through his mop head. "Oh, them. I mean, we don't have to." Crunch, crunch, nachos. "No, it's fine, it's fine. My dad's in finance and my mom is a fundraiser on the Dallas scene."
"Oh, cool," I say.
"Yeah, cool if I go into finance."
"Have you always wanted to be a novelist?"
"Ever since I read Roald Dahl, yeah."
"Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory."
"Actually, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I think Willy Wonka was just the film title."
"Oh," I go, "right."
Nothing followed by nothing. And then, "What are your other favorite movies that were books first?" he says. He has had 3 chips total. I have had something like 1,000. "Well," I say, "there are the obvious ones. The Shining, Carrie, Talented Mr. Ripley. So are you just crazy obsessed with movies, or do you actually want to make them someday?" Wow, I'm a little insulted and don't even have a right to be. If I don't tell him about Annabeth, I can't be pissed he doesn't know about Q&A productions. But this is my thing about why I think relationships, boyfriends, friends, anything, are such a hassle. I have lived for almost 17 years. That is so much to catch somebody up about. I want people just to arrive in my life fully informed of my tastes and fears. The lists are pretty short, definitely memorizable. I wish they could just be distributed to would-be suitors ahead of time so they could rule themselves out. Or in. I'm open to in, too.
Yeah, I say. I guess I'd like to make movies someday.
I discreetly check my shirt and notice only the chocolate ghost stain with no nacho cheese sauce in sight. And when I look up again, Amir goes, "Can I get you a drink?" But his eyes are shiny, 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 like there's another set of eyes behind them. He's up to something.
"I'm good, thanks," I say, holding up a bottle of water.
"No, I mean," he goes, leaning in on his elbows. His t-shirt tugs at the collar. His chest. He has a really nice chest. You could land a helicopter on it. "Do you want a beer?" I try to play it cool. I so want a beer. I also don't want to get in trouble or caught or something. I'm already out way too late, already worried my mom has called Jeff's mom, asking where he and I went to dinner.
"Definitely," I say, just like that, loud. And he slaps his hands down on the table and goes, "Cool."
I watch his baggy jeans and tight t-shirt walk away, and I'm looking at my forearms and thinking how hairless and sticky they are on account of this disgusting table, and he is back faster than I could have guessed. Time is relative these days.
"At your service, monsieur."
Amir places the plastic cup down in front of me, and perhaps he is a secret magician because as I reach for it, he goes, "Go slow," as if he absolutely and without a doubt knows this is my first beer ever. I'm sipping and sipping and waiting for it to be good. And I go, "Well, how about you? Favorite book to movie adaptations?" And by the way, Amir's slow about eating food, but half his beer is gone in 2 gulps.
"See, I don't have your extensive knowledge," he goes. "I think the only adaptation I'm confident I've seen is the 10 Commandments,"
which is a pretty good joke, so I throw it a laugh. I take another sip of beer. "Nope. Still gross."
"Hey," I go, "will you look a movie thing up on your phone?"
"Sure, Mom," he says. My face can't hide any lies, so Amir goes, "I'm teasing, Quinn," really soft and sweet, and he taps his knee into mine under this table and goes, "Okay, what am I looking up?"
"Okay, Google Ricky Devlin new movie."
"Who's that?" Just some guy. A golden guy. Like an old babysitter. The screen above our heads is broadcasting this vintage Pittsburgh Pirates game. It's like a 24/7 loop of the best games ever. And there's a table of guys two nachos over who are reacting to it as if in this very moment they can't believe the home run that is currently being home runned. Okay, there's a bunch of results, Amir goes. You want to see? I take a really big swig of beer, developing a new theory that maybe it tastes better in large quantities. And when that proves false but exhilarating, I burp a little as I'm saying, no, just read one to me. And he goes, easy, slugger. I put the beer down and pick at my nails, difficult as they're already nearly picked to kingdom come. Okay, so there's something from Deadline a few months ago. Perfect. Yeah, read that. No Such Thing as Fire and Battle Axe 3 Scorpion's Fury screenwriter Ricky Devlin's spec script, South Hill's Apprentice, was acquired by Relativity Studios in a deal brokered by WME. Script centers around a college dropout home for the summer who develops a bond with a complicated antisocial child and ends up learning lessons about death, life, and... Hey, Amir looks up from his iPhone. You have a little something. I can't tell what he means about the little something. I am only puzzling together that I am the complicated antisocial child around whom this screenplay is based, and that perhaps this sounds like the worst movie ever. How could Ricky Devlin be dumb enough to write an autobiographical screenplay about us and actually sell the damn thing? Amir's reaching across and swiping something from my lip, and I wince away. I wince away, just like Jeff did to my mom on the counter. It's just a beer mustache, Amir says, putting his phone on camera mode and flipping it to show me. I look like some math nerd in a porn. These ridiculous glasses, this haircut utterly lacking in style, this white froth mustache foaming me up like some kid Einstein. Oh my God, kid Einstein. One of my first movies ever with Annabeth. I had this idea. What if Einstein and Freud and Hitler and Earhart, Amelia, had all been kids together? What if they'd been in school together? Kid Einstein, Kid Hitler, Kid Freud, and Kid Earhart, who'd be played by nobody, because the joke was, even in middle school, Amelia Earhart was always missing. What if we don't cast anybody? Annabeth offered after I read her the first draft of my script. Always her. Only her. What if we cut all of Amelia's scenes? It was her idea. All my best ideas were actually her ideas. Did you know that? Whoops, my beer's all gone. Hey, Amir says. He is next to me on this sticky banquette. Everything is sticky. His arm is around my shoulder and I can smell his deodorant. I want to be attracted to this. I should be, but I'm not. He's my exact same height, but he is so much stronger than I am that I feel like he could crush me, and I know that seeing Annabeth's face on the side of the building should have wrecked me tonight, but it didn't. It numbed me. What's wrecking me is the breathtakingly stupid stuff, the stuff I don't plan on, how Annabeth is the only person in the world who would appreciate a Kid Einstein reference, how she is the only person I'd be brave enough to share a first draft with. I want another beer. I say, and Amir, who's doing that super gentle shoulder rub maneuver where just a guy's thumb is going up and down, goes, "Oh, Wynn, maybe that's enough for tonight." I whip my head so hard to look at him that our glasses almost smack, and I say, "What did you call me?" Wynn, you know, short for Quinn, I guess. That's what she called me. That was ours. She called me Wynn and nobody else did, and I want to stand up and knock this table over and eat everybody's nachos and run out of this place screaming. But instead, I play it like a Western and I grit my jaw and I say through my teeth, I would really like another beer. Amir scoots over to say, here, you can finish mine and then we should go. And I don't even wait for half the sentence to be gone before I am gulping his down. And you know what? My theory is right. At a certain moment when you drink through enough of it, beer starts to become a kind of buzzing neutral. Whoa there! Amir says when I leap up and knock my hip really, really hard against the edge of the table. I think the sound escaping me is a laugh, but oh God, it's not. It's the weak, inbred cousin of laughter, and I don't do this. I only cry alone. The table next to us is left behind a bunch of half-empty beers, and ladies and gentlemen, guess who chugs them all, one after the other, germs and dignity be damned. 20 seconds later, Amir's got me under his arm, limping a little bit to the parking lot. I should probably be thankful that he is sweet enough to smile at me and say, "That's amazing, you still got the little beer mustache going." But instead of thinking it's sweet, I'm just seeing Kid Einstein on the megaplex screen of my mind, and I say, "I think I need to go home." And other than Amir buckling me in, that's the last thing I remember. Chapter 18. According to local sources, I slept in my bathtub last night. Jesus, I say, Christ. This is the kind of hangover people write horror movies about. Movies that are never funded because they're too graphic. If you don't know what a hangover feels like, congrats. You're smarter than I am. It's like a sledgehammer eloped with a swing set and they honeymooned in your head. I lift my foot to turn the water on with my toe, and after it cools down a bit, I let it drench my legs. That's when I notice I'm still in my one good pair of underwear, and just that. Amir? I call out, louder than a smart kid would. These walls are so thin, Mom can probably hear every last detail of my life. Nothing. Okay, so he's not here. Oh my God, thank God. When my legs have been chilled enough so that I guess they start circulating the blood back up in a way that's vaguely refreshing, I see the pile of last night's cologned clothes sitting next to the commode. Something is sticking out of the pocket of my jean shorts, which are hanging off the toilet plunger. The glamour of it all. I reach for my shirt so I can dry off my hands, and when I pull the note out of my shorts, I discover a message written in small, serial killer block letters on thick graph paper. The paper of somebody who wants to be remembered. Wynn, if I can call you that? Hoo boy, I turn the water off to prep for this moment. Thank you for being so honest with me last night. Thank you for feeling comfortable enough to cry in front of me. Feel better. Sleep it off. Let's hang again before I go west, young man. Amir. And then, P.S. Thank you especially for finally telling me about your sister. Oh, God. I place the note on the lid of my toilet. I hold my breath to dunk my head under, and I am forced to wonder how long it might take to drown. Not that I'd have the nerve for it. Please, I squeal when I pop zits. So when I'm up again and cradling my face in my hands, the weight and the throbbing of all these questions begin to push through and pool at my eyelids. And the first question I'm seeing is, what did I tell him last night about Annabeth on the ride back to my house? Does he now know the things only the police and my mom and my therapist know? I try to stand, but it doesn't work out so hot. And so I'm back to sitting with all these thoughts about so many different maybes, which crowd into one another like horrible party guests making trouble in a bathroom. Maybe I finally told somebody about how I had gotten into a huge fight with my sister on the morning of December 20th, about how she was prioritizing everything else, including, of course, her college applications, over shooting my unfinished screenplay last fall. Maybe I told Amir how I sent her a text that day after she stopped me in the hallway outside calculus and said, "I'm canceling the shoot after school, Quinn. I'm free last period and I want to do some Christmas shopping." And my temper revved up zero to red hot and I said, "I can't believe you. I bet the Coen brothers would never cancel an important shoot day." And Annabeth snorted and said, "We're not the Coen brothers. They co-direct their films and they finish their screenplays first." And my teacher said, "Class started 30 seconds ago, Mr. Roberts." And maybe I told Amir that the text I sent to Annabeth after our fight that day was something like, "You're dead to me," in all caps. And by something like, I mean exactly like. We texted constantly, so when she didn't reply to, "You're dead to me," I wrote back, okay, I was kidding, geez. When she finally did text me back that afternoon, I turned off my phone in a huff, without even reading it, without realizing it would be her last text ever. I get up from the tub, slow, with plenty of shakes. My underwear is so heavy with water that I feel as if I'm in diapers. I wish I were. The chance to start over. "Quinny," I hear Mom say quietly from the bottom of the stairs. "Come on downstairs. Somebody's got a surprise at the front door." I towel down. I hate surprises. I throw my wet underwear in the sink and I head to my closet. Not to get changed, but to grab that film competition application from the top of my untouched textbook pile. "One sec, Ma." I put on my maroon robe and walk the application to the toilet to brush Amir's note to the floor and to flip open the lid and to flush my half-finished summer plans down the drain where they belong. And as I'm watching it try to fight and struggle to swirl away, I am wondering one more maybe about last night. Did I tell Amir the big act break, the big drama of my life story? That Annabeth was killed right after sending one last text to somebody in her phone listed as Wynn? "You folks know who a Wynn might be?" the police asked my mom that night when they showed up after school to find half the neighborhood ladies huddled around her in the kitchen. A coalition of moms, each of them happier than the next, not to be mine. "You folks know who a Wynn might be?" they asked. And my mom looked up and said, "That's what Annabeth called her brother." I was already upstairs with my earplugs in, never having turned my phone back on after school. But Mom has told and retold her version of the story to me as if I'll come up with an alternative ending to it. The definitive director's cut. The one that leaves the audience smiling instead of stunned. I wonder what Amir actually thinks of me now. The lightweight who turned himself into an only child. The boy whose big sister coasted out of the last period of the day and right through a red light while sending one last message to me, a message that not even my mom has seen, that I still haven't had the guts to turn my phone on and read, calcified and preserved somewhere in my room like the only pirate treasure you'd never want to find. I tie the robe shut, hide Amir's serial killer note under my pillow, and exit my bedroom. But not before nearly tripping over a pair of bowling shoes, which are sitting by my door like polite foreign exchange students on the terrible summer immersion trip that is my life. I must have accidentally worn them home last night. Like mother, like son. "Quinn, I'm coming," I say to her, heading down to my first morning as a 17-year-old. Chapter 19. So, Jeff is standing at the front door holding an ice cream cake. That is happening. "I don't like ice cream cakes," I say to him like a jagoff. "You think hangovers are going to be a joke?" And then, "I know," he says, holding it out. "It isn't from me." I squint at him, and then Mom's behind me like an annoying sidekick with, "That's the Jeff I know, face clean as a baby's butt." "I don't think baby's butts are really all that clean, Mrs. R," Jeff says, rubbing the place his mustache used to occupy. Jeff has been kind of a dick to me these last couple of days, but now he's looking at Mom like the two of them used to have an act on a cruise ship. I look through the plastic packaging of the cake box. "Happy Birthday, Wynn" is spelled out in frosting, and it takes my breath away. Seriously, it's like the cake steals my breath, like some children's book villain. And I think, did my sister send Jeff a message from the grave to deliver to me? Unlikely. The two of them were always at each other's throats. "Well, let me put that in the freezer so it doesn't melt," Mom says, taking the cake from me and making her way into the kitchen and then back to the sunroom. My hands are cool and my head is hot. Also, Annabeth knows I hate ice cream cake, so Amir asked me to buy it for you, Jeff whispers.
Well, ask Jeffy to come in, birthday boy,
Mom shouts, but he stays put. It's cooler out here, he goes, leaning in and looking past my shoulder. What is your mom doing in there? Well, I hear it too. Some kind of rhythmic ripping of fabric. Every few months, Mom goes through a crafts phase. Ignore. So wait, I go, stepping outside and letting our screen door thwap shut behind me. Amir, like, asked you to buy me an ice cream cake?
Yup,
Jeff says, blocking the sun. His eyes are the bluest blue. Leave it to a straight boy to have the most classic features and then squander them with terrible gold neck chains and jeans choices. He said, go get one of those Carvel cakes, but have them do a million flavors that don't really go together. It'll make Wynn laugh. And so I laugh. Oh, yeah, long story involving crazy froyo choices from last night. Wow, you already have inside jokes. Also, wow, I thought only Annabeth called you Wynn. Now I shield my eyes, too. She does. I mean, she did. But he kind of came up with it, too. Also, all